today, inside Australia's asylum system, now being seen as a possible model for the UK.
Our asylum system is fundamentally broken, and we have a responsibility to act.
A few weeks ago, the Home Secretary Priti Patel gave this speech at the Conservative Party conference and talked about Britain's asylum system, which she believes urgently needs reforming. This year, the number of people who have crossed the Channel in small boats to seek asylum in the UK has increased fourfold.
So I will introduce a new system that is firm and fair. Fair and compassionate towards those who need our help.
According to leaked reports, some of the policies her department are considering include deploying water cannons to create waves, using nets to push back boats, and processing asylum seekers on islands thousands of miles away, like Papua New Guinea, which has been used by Australia for offshoring since 2001. It's a system Guardian Australia reporter Ben Doherty knows all too well.
There is a grim familiarity about hearing these policies being essentially recycled. These are not novel ideas. They're politically very attractive to governments, particularly governments that want to be seen to be cracking down on immigration, to be taking control. But what gets lost in all of these policies is what it does to the people at the heart of it.
One of those people is Boruz Buchani, who spent 7 years in detention in Papua New Guinea.
That place that we were was worse than a prison, because in a prison, the prisoners know how long they should stay in that prison. But we didn't know. And when you don't know how long you stay in that prison, it's a huge torture. I don't know how to describe it. People feel, why am I here? And what is my crime? That is banishment. They banished us.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, what does an Australian-style asylum system actually mean? Just a note before we start. In this episode, we do hear accounts of abuse and talk about suicide. Ben, the UK government is reportedly looking at how they can process asylum seekers outside the UK. Australia has been using this process of offshoring for some time, but how does it actually work?
The rationale behind the Australian policy is to physically prevent people from ever reaching Australian territory, from ever setting foot on Australian soil to be able to claim asylum in Australia. Australia is a party to the Refugees Convention, and it has legal obligations for people who come to Australia and say, I'm an asylum seeker seeking protection. Australia is legally obliged to assess that claim for protection. What the Australian policies do is to stop people ever getting to that point. So Australia's gone to extraordinary lengths to do that. Australia has excised part of its own territory, Christmas Island, in the Indian Ocean, and said, for migration purposes, that is no longer part of Australia. So if an asylum seeker reaches Christmas Island, which a lot of boats have been doing, they're not entitled to make a claim for protection in Australia. Those people are immediately taken from there, and they're taken to Nauru, which is a tiny independent state in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It's about the size of an airport, the entire country, and Australia has built a detention centre on Nauru Island. The other place that Australia sends asylum seekers to is to an island called Manus in Papua New Guinea. So basically, Australia is exporting its asylum obligations to other countries. The other thing that Australia does is physically stop boats from ever getting into Australian territorial waters. So the Australian Navy and the Australian Border Force patrol the north and west of Australia, in particular where most boats come from, and physically pushes boats back into international waters. They will intercept boats of asylum seekers. They will disable those boats and put people in lifeboats and push them back towards Indonesia, where a lot of boats come.
Push them back.
The idea is physically to keep people from ever reaching Australia so they can't exercise their legal right in this country.
And the Navy escorted us until Indonesian water and they forcibly returned us back to Indonesia.
This is the second lifeboat found in Indonesia since Australia announced its new policy of turning back asylum seekers. Indonesia has strongly condemned the policy that has seriously strained ties between the two countries.
I mean, pushing them back towards another country, is any of this legal, Ben?
There is extensive legal opinion that says that this is not legal under international law, that Australia has obligations to protect people rather than to push them back to other places. There have been cases where Australian government employees have been accused of bribing boat captains to turn boats around and send them back. There have been cases where people have been put into boats made by the Australian government that have then foundered on their way back to Indonesia or run out of fuel. So these are very dangerous situations that people are being put back into. And the overwhelming weight of legal opinion in international law is that this is not lawful.
When did Australia first use offshoring for asylum seekers?
It really should be noted that arriving unannounced by boat in Australia is not a novel concept. This is an island, and people have been arriving here for tens of thousands of years on boats. European settlement came 200 years ago, and boats carrying asylum seekers began arriving in the mid-1970s from the Indo-Chinese conflict. But in 2001, there was a watershed moment, I suppose, in Australian politics when a small fishing boat called the Palapa One ran into trouble in international waters off Australia's northwest coast.
The 20-metre boat was packed to the brim, overcrowded and overloaded.
We had kids crying and adults crying, and we were hoping that it won't be the night that we are going to sink.
An emergency call was brought out, and a Norwegian freighter called the Tampa rescued 433 Afghan asylum seekers on that boat.
We have been asking for medical help and a doctor on board to take a look at these people.
The closest port was Australia. Christmas Island was the closest place for that boat to bring those people to safety, and Australia refused to let the boat in. In fact, sent its military on board that ship to stop it from taking those people to Australia. There was this extraordinary standoff.
When the Australian commandos came in, inside the Tampa, with the guns on our heads, we were kind of scared that something is wrong.
This happened in the middle of an election campaign in Australia in August of 2001, and then in September 2001 with the 9/11 attacks. And all of a sudden, the idea around migration, the idea around unregulated migration in particular, became this incredibly acute political issue. And John Howard, who was the Conservative Prime Minister at the time, famously said in his campaign speech,
"We will decide who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come."
Now, the black letters of that are fairly unremarkable, that countries have borders and are allowed to control who crosses them. But the message underlying that, and Howard was often accused of dog whistling to the sort of far right anti-immigration elements of his party and the Australian constituency, was that we will stop these people coming. We'll make sure that no one gets to Australia this way. And that's where we saw very, very hastily enacted, and I'm talking in a matter of days, this new concept known then as the Pacific Solution.
It does give us the basis of handling the problem consistent with the assertion by Australia that our border integrity is not to be breached.
The Pacific Solution was essentially offshore processing, that no one who came to Australia by boat seeking asylum would be allowed to stay in Australia. They would be sent offshore and processed offshore. And that's when Australia began sending asylum seekers to Nauru.
So this was a perfect storm in a sense. You had this awful case of hundreds of asylum seekers being found at sea, coupled with the election and, as you said, 9/11.
You're right. This was a confluence of all of these events that created this situation where a policy like the Pacific Solution, which previously I think would have been unthinkable in the Australian context, is all of a sudden not only being considered but being implemented. I think another couple of factors fed into that, and that is a long-standing concern about migration, a discomfort with migration, particularly from Asia, in parts of the Australian constituency, but also in the right wing of Australian politics. But also, I think it needs to be acknowledged that this concern was ruthlessly exploited by the Howard government and governments that followed to kind of enlarge and to play on those fears in the Australian population, to make the idea of people seeking asylum in this country appear to be a threat.
It's not a race question so much as a question of culture. And we have good reason to worry about militant Islam.
John Howard, who had a very keen ear for the Australian electorate, would often talk about migration being acceptable to Australia as long as it was seen as being controlled, that the government was in charge of who was coming and how they came. He argued that people wouldn't tolerate people simply arriving in Australia to make a claim for asylum.
Tell me about Nauru. Where is it, and why did the Australian government decide to set up a processing system there?
Nauru is one of the smallest countries in the world. It's a tiny, single Pacific island, essentially about 4 hours east off Australia's coast in the Pacific. It was once about the second richest country on Earth. It had immense amounts of phosphate in the middle of the island, which was ruthlessly mined by the British, by Australia, by New Zealand and others, and basically strip mined an entire country.
The change began when European explorers moved into the Pacific and was accelerated when phosphate was discovered here at the turn of the century. Phosphate is the only economic resource of the island, and from it stem the improved living standards.
The country managed to fritter away almost all of that money in some pretty extraordinary ways. And this has essentially left this sort of shell of a country, a state that's been left in permanent penury. It has a very small population of about 10,000 people and is massively dependent upon Australian aid, whose currency it uses, and is basically beholden to the whims of the Australian government. So when Australia was casting about the Pacific for somewhere where it could impose its will to build an immigration detention centre, Nauru was a very obvious starting point.
And what system did they establish there, and who was running it?
Australia built a series of immigration detention camps. These were very securitised places built with very high fences. The guards carried weapons. It's very hot all the time. It rains a lot. The facilities were poor. There was not very much running water. Things were breaking all the time. These were very barren and very desolate places. These places were, for all intents and purposes, under the control of the Australian government. The Australian government would argue that legal authority rested with the Nauru government or with the private contractors that it hired to run security or to process asylum claims. But essentially, these were, and numerous inquiries have found this and court judgments have found this, that the Australian government was in charge of these immigration detention centres.
And they didn't just build one on Nauru. Another detention centre was set up on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea. Who was being sent to these places and what was meant to happen to them?
Over the years, the cohorts have changed quite significantly, but Afghans and Iranians and Sri Lankans have been consistently significant cohorts, as well as a number of stateless people, in particular Rohingya from Myanmar. The idea was that processing would happen offshore and people's asylum claims would be assessed against the criteria of the Refugees Convention, and then people would be found with what's known in international refugee law as a durable solution, somewhere where they could resettle and rebuild their lives anew. Initially, the idea was that that would be in Australia, and the idea of having offshore processing was to put a gap in between people arriving by boat and being allowed to settle in the Australian community. It should be noted that over the duration of Australia's offshore processing policies, the number of people found to be owed refugee protection is about 90%. So the vast majority of people arriving need protection, are fleeing persecution, and are obliged by Australia to be protected. The way offshore processing developed was that people would then never come back to Australia. They would then be resettled in third countries that Australia would do deals with, essentially, and basically swap obligations to resettle refugees. And Australia has cast about all over the world, in fact, for other countries where they've tried to send people, anything to stop people coming to Australia and actually end up settling here.
Were Australian politicians and the public in support of these camps?
These policies were electorally popular, but there was always a significant minority in Australia that was firmly opposed to these policies and deeply worried about what was happening on these islands that we weren't allowed to know about. And as more information became known, as there were deaths on these islands, as the sort of deprivations and the violence of these camps became more widely known.
Sadisa fled Iraq after her husband was arrested and killed by the government. She's in the camp with her children.
I want to go out from here. I want to leave this place. It is very unfair. I get tired. I can't stand it anymore.
My son, another one, his hand broken about 10 months. No one take him to hospital.
Now they're claiming they don't have enough food or they don't have enough fresh water or supplies, and no one providing basic services.
Well, let me just say that food and water, no matter how many times you suggest that it is not available, is provided. Now, the fact that they tell you, for the purposes of trying to evoke sympathy, that that's not available is, I think, not creditable.
There was an increasing amount of public disquiet about what was being done. Australia's reputation internationally was being significantly damaged, and eventually it became too difficult of a political problem to maintain, and these camps were all closed in 2008.
And then what happened?
These camps were held in abeyance, and the new Labor government in Australia promised that offshore processing had ended and would not be restarted.
We have committed to ending the so-called Pacific Solution. We would not have offshore processing in Manus Island and Nauru.
But within 4 years, in 2012, the camps were reopened and asylum seekers were again being sent back to these places.
After years of criticising the Howard government's Pacific Solution for asylum seekers, Labor looks set to build an offshore processing centre in Papua New Guinea.
What has always driven me is my belief in strong border protection.
Why was that? Having said that they wouldn't reopen their camps, the government then did make that U-turn. What do you think it was that persuaded them to do that?
There was a very significant increase in Tamil asylum seekers leaving Sri Lanka and coming directly to Australia, straight across the Indian Ocean. And that was caused by the very, very violent end to the civil war in that country.
Another boatload of refugees has been caught off the coast, just a few hours' drive north of the capital. It's the 25th boat caught since July, headed for Christmas Island.
When you get those optics, isn't it, that it gets politicians thinking about these much blunter methods to deal with it?
When it's on the news every night that there's another boat coming, and when the issue is used in a divisive political way to sort of score points against the opposition and say they've lost control or say they don't have a plan, that sort of pressure on a government is incredibly acute. And it builds and it builds another boat and another boat and another boat. And the way the issue is framed of people seeking asylum as a threat to Australia became this kind of lightning rod of Australian politics.
Ben, when did you first start looking into what was happening on Nauru and Manus Island?
From 2014, as immigration correspondent for The Guardian in Australia, I really began to look as forensically as I could at these distant places that I couldn't get to find out exactly what was happening in Nauru and in Manus Island. I applied 5 times for a visa to Nauru and was rejected every time. I went to Manus Island several times to sort of see what was happening on that place. These places are not accidentally remote. It's a deliberate and significant part of the policy that they're physically far away as well, that people who are sent to these islands can't be seen, can't be spoken to, and that these things are pushed literally over the horizon where the Australian public doesn't know what's going on. So that's no accident.
So very difficult then to get access. And you said you managed, though, to get to Manus. What do you remember about visiting there?
Going to Manus Island is pretty confronting. I was able to communicate with people via phone, essentially through the fence. I was able to see the detention centre from the outside, and I was able to see how imposing these fences were, the level of security and guards going on. I mean, it was physically housed within a military base that was very, very difficult to get into and onto. The stories coming out of there were quite extraordinary in terms of the violence of these places, the complete disregard for people's mental health or physical health. There was extraordinary negligence and extraordinary neglect.
Behrouz Bichani is a Kurdish-Iranian journalist who fled Iran in fear for his life in 2013. The boat he was travelling in was intercepted between Indonesia and Australia, and he was taken to Manus Island. He stayed there until 2017.
Of course, this circumstances was really difficult because there was not hygiene facility, there was not medical system there. 7 people died, killed by the system there. Mostly because of medical neglect and violence. And many people, after 6 years, 7 years, many people traumatized, many people damaged physically and mentally. That is not a prison. That is worse than a prison.
Behrouz began to work with Ben, reporting on the abuse that was taking place.
We didn't have access to phone. So we had to smuggle phone in. So there were some local officers were working there. So we exchanged cigarettes with phone. So I brought a phone in and I started to communicate with the world. And through that phone, I knew Ben Doherty and we worked together. It was really difficult because the only time that people hear something from us was when some people died. And it was only just for a day, and then people forget about it. We had to struggle to send our voice out and people hear us.
Coming up, what happened when The Guardian published an explosive report which revealed what life was like for people trapped in detention on Nauru. Ben, what journalists like you and Baruz were able to report revealed how devastating the conditions were on Manus Island, but it was much harder to work out what was happening on Nauru. That was until 2016, when The Guardian published a cache of leaked documents known as the Nauru Files. What did they tell you about the asylum system on that island?
The Nauru Files was a cache of thousands of documents that were basically the internal working papers of this immigration detention centre. These were incredibly bureaucratic places, incredibly hierarchical places. There were forms to be filled out for everything. If you needed medication, you had to fill out a form. If you needed a new pair of shoes, you filled out a different form. There was this attempt, I suppose, to impose this sort of very strict bureaucratic order on these places. So this generated an awful lot of paperwork, and this paperwork found its way to us, and we went through it. And what it revealed, in particular around Nauru, Manus was for single men, but Nauru was a family camp, and so there were a great many children in that place. And what the Nauru Files detailed was an extraordinary level of abuse of children, that the people working in this place, who were guards looking after this place, did not have any checks about their backgrounds and those things. There were people who were sexually abusing children, violently attacking children. Women were being raped. There was a litany of these sorts of offences and abuses that are laid out in absolutely stark detail in these files. And I think one of the reasons why those Nauru Files were so powerful and so impactful was that this was not outsiders talking about what's going on in those places, but this was the guards themselves filling out forms about who's been abused and what's happened and what they saw. This was the reports going back to the minister saying, this is what's happened in this place. This was the regime talking to itself and revealing itself to be awful.
And what did it tell you that you didn't know before about what was happening to people there?
It confirmed for us what we'd been hearing from people inside, but revealed just how widespread those things were. The instances we'd been reporting about, the assaults, the sexual violence, we understood these to be irregular occurrences, to be anomalies to the functioning of this system. What we found was a system that was completely broken and had no capacity to protect the people it was supposed to. Women were incredibly vulnerable in this place. Children were acutely vulnerable in this place.
Pigs throw food on the ground. They give pig and we don't like pigs. They say, do you want to eat? And we don't. The teachers fight us and the teachers hit us with the ruler. We are not animals, we are humans.
I don't have anything, literally anything. The only thing I had was a few friends. Now, they had to kill themselves. They had to try to suicide to save themselves from this place.
And the system was basically allowing this to happen and essentially reporting it but doing nothing to stop it. The widespread extent and the widespread acceptance of this level of violence and predation was just astounding.
Were there any particular stories that stood out to you?
I think what was happening to young children in that place was particularly difficult to read. There were stories, one in particular that just almost never leaves me, of a two-year-old boy who just repeatedly banged his head against a wall all day, every day, because that's all there was in his life.
That's awful.
Nothing could have prepared me for the extent of the deprivation and the complete inaction that happened, that these children were left in these heartbreaking, just simply awful situations that to this day I still remember and can't let go, that nothing was done, that this was something that we were choosing to do to children. There was no compulsion around this. This was a decision. This was a policy decision that was taken to inflict this misery on these people.
What was the reaction to the release of these files?
The reaction was pretty extreme. A lot of people in the Australian community were utterly shocked by the Nauru Files and simply the extent of the violence, the extent of the negligence. There was a parliamentary inquiry into it, and it really did sort of change the nature of the debate, in that it was understood that these weren't acceptable places, that liberal democracies don't run offshore prisons like this. The PNG Supreme Court said that the detention centre on Manus Island was illegal and Australia was forced to look elsewhere.
So what happened to the people who are being detained on Manus and also on Nauru?
The camps are still physically there. Manus has been shut down by order of the PNG Supreme Court. The Nauru camp exists, but people have been moved out and are being housed in houses in the community.
This whole policy was set up to stop people from making it to mainland Australia. But were some able to do this?
For lots of people, they've become so unwell, so sick in these places, places where there is no sort of tertiary medical care, that they've had to be brought back to Australia. Many are in Australia on what's called a bridging visa, which can be as short as 28 days before you get another one and maybe another one, and you're left in this sort of limbo about when you'll be allowed to properly re-begin a new life. A great many people are being held in detention in Australia, either in immigration detention centres or in hotels that the Australian Border Force has essentially commandeered. The policy just hasn't worked as a way to get people to the next stage, which is a durable solution where they begin rebuilding their lives.
Ben, it's clear that this system is incredibly traumatic for the people that are subjected to it. And it's also a very expensive way of processing asylum seekers. Are the government able to claim it's been successful?
They do. The argument around success is that they've stopped the boats. That was a political slogan that won Tony Abbott the Prime Ministership, saying he would stop the boats. You punish one group of people in order to deter another group from trying to arrive by boat. They have been successful in doing that, and boats don't come to Australia in the same numbers that they did previously. But more people arrive by plane to Australia to claim asylum than have ever arrived by boat. And the idea that this issue is as simple as simply stopping boats and stopping dangerous sea journeys, I think answers the wrong question. The question that needs to be asked is, are more people who need protection getting it? And the answer from these policies is no. They're being physically stopped from getting to a place that can protect them. It was a disastrous policy.
Baruz, what would you say to people in the UK government reportedly considering offshoring refugees like yourself?
I should say this to people in UK. The politic in Australia is broken now because of this policy, because they lost morality, they lost values, they lost all of these valuable concepts. This policy, of course, damaged the refugees, but damaged Australia too. And that's why you should don't say, okay, I exile, I banish these refugees, these people to that island, and so we protect ourselves. No, dictatorship is like cancer. That dictatorship that they created in those islands towards the refugees, innocent people, now expand, you know, spread around to other structures in Australia. They arrested some journalists. They arrested whistleblowers. They are treating the activists for climate change in a way they treat the refugees. If you want to damage your democracy, if you want to give power to some politicians who always use this fear based off the refugees to win the election, if you want to damage your country, let's do it. If you do this, you lose your humanity, you lose your principles, you lose your money, and you let the corrupt politicians to always manipulate you very, very easily.
Baruz, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Thank you.
That was Baruz Bouchani and Ben Doherty. You can read more of their reporting on Manus and Nauru at theguardian.com. Baruz's book, No Friend But the Mountains, is available to buy now. If you want to understand more about the UK government's response to asylum seekers, I really recommend going back and listening to Who Are the People Risking Everything to Cross the Channel, a podcast we made with Harriet Grant back in August. We put the allegations made in this episode to the Australian Department of Home Affairs, and a spokesperson told us that the coalition government remains committed to preventing vulnerable people from risking their lives at sea. Regional processing is a key pillar of the government's strong border protection policies, and in line with Australian government policy, no one under regional processing arrangements will be settled in Australia. They emphasise that regional processing arrangements are implemented in accordance with international law and with respect for human rights, but that the management of individuals within them are the responsibility of the Nauru and PNG governments. In response to the Nauru files, the government stated that all alleged criminal incidents are referred to the Nauru police force for investigation, that the documents published are evidence of the rigorous reporting procedures in place, but are not statements of proven fact, and that they take seriously their role in supporting the government of Nauru to protect children from abuse, neglect, or exploitation. They noted that since 2013, regional processing populations in Nauru and PNG have steadily declined, with no new transfers occurring since 2014, and no persons now in detention with restricted movement. They also said that they do not comment on on-water operations or assets where it may provide advantage to people smugglers, but that it has been more than 6.5 years since the last death at sea resulting from maritime people smuggling to Australia. Finally, they say Australia's policies are designed for Australia's unique circumstances. They reinforce safe and legal migration pathways for those in need and discourage people from relying on people smugglers. The UK Home Office told us that they are fixing a broken asylum system and will establish one that will be compassionate to those who need our help while stopping the exploitation of those who come here illegally and make unfounded claims. They also said that they do not comment on leaks, are looking at what a host of other countries do with regards to asylum, and will bring forward legislation to make these changes next year. Today's episode was produced by Courtney Youssef and Rose DeLarabiti. Sound design was by Axel Kakutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.